excellent quotes from literature, philosophy, and from films themselves, and from deep research, as well as interviews with available heirs. It is a must-read for fans of Billy Wilder, but also students of great film criticism. Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You're listening to That Vegan Show. I'm your host, Melissa Lesniak. Today, we're going to be talking about cultured meat. But before we get to that, don't forget that we're in the middle of annual spring membership drive. At KBOO, radio is our business. And you can help our radio hive thrive this spring drive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to become a monthly sustaining member today. Help us reach our fundraising goal of 56,000. And I know I'm in the right place because Melissa means bee in Greek, so this is the fun driver to support this show. All right, let's meet our guest today, Shannon Falconer. She's the CEO and co-founder of Because Animals. And Because Animals is a small company with a big mission to make the most sustainable and nutritious food for dogs and cats on the planet without ever harming any animals or the environment, which, yay. I love this. So I'm so excited to meet you today, Shannon, and hear about this.
Yeah, thanks very much, Melissa. I'm really happy to be here.
Okay, I would love to hear how this idea got started.
Sure. Well, I guess it started probably when I was a very small child. I grew up with three dogs and three cats. I stopped eating meat at a very young age for animal welfare reasons, and in my teens started volunteering at animal rescue charities, and then that continued throughout my 20s and my 30s. I'm a biochemist by training, so while I was working on my PhD in the lab, I was sort of doing volunteer rescue stuff in the evenings, and I didn't really ever see any way for my science and my dedication to animals to merge. But then when I was working as a postdoctoral research fellow at Stanford University in 2016, that perspective changed. And it was really then that I decided that I would put my scientific training to taking animals out of the supply chain. So initially I thought I would do something that was related to the human food category, because of course humans are the main consumers of animal-based products. But then as I started to think about it more and sort of look at myself, like, okay, well, I mean, I'm not consuming animal-based products, but I feel hamstrung by, you know, I have to sort of serve the industry because I'm still buying food for my pets. And then when I looked at just what the contribution of the pet food industry to the animal agriculture industry, what that contribution is, that's when I realized that really pet food was where I had to dedicate my work. So something that a lot of people don't realize is that the majority of pet food is made from something called 4D meat, or animals that are dead, diseased, dying, and disabled. The pet food industry doesn't like that. They don't like that terminology, obviously, but these are otherwise referred to as fallen animals. So animals that die in transit due to dehydration or suffocation. So if an animal it doesn't make it to slaughter, it dies before slaughter, that meat is inedible for human consumption. And there's a lot of meat that falls into that category. So all of that meat, rather than it basically going to the landfill, rather than the animal agriculture industry having to pay to have it disposed of as biohazardous waste at the landfill, the animal agriculture industry is able to then turn a profit on this otherwise unsellable meat by selling it to pet food. So although there's sort of this broad misconception that pet food is actually a sustainable industry, because, you know, people would say, well, this is really, these are the parts of the animal that humans don't want to eat or don't eat because of this this business about how, as I just mentioned, they're fallen animals. The other way to look at this, the more accurate way to look at this, is to say, well, really, the pet food industry is sustaining this otherwise unsustainable industry, which is the animal agriculture industry. Nonetheless, there are just no companies that are focused on really taking animals out of the supply chain when it comes to pet food. So that was where, that's sort of in a nutshell how the motivation behind the company and why we decided, my co-founder Joshua Aaron and I decided to focus on pet food.
That's wonderful, because it definitely can be a dilemma for people. And also, you know, having many cats myself, I see, you know, how they're getting all these diseases, and some of these factors you're talking about, I assume, are a pretty big cause of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the issues with pet food, the current pet food, the source of the meat, it is, so every year, multiple times a year, the FDA issues recalls on pet food, typically due to chemical or bacterial contamination. It has even been found, and the FDA has recalled pet food due to the presence of something called pentobarbital in pet food. And pentobarbital is a chemical that's a euthanizing agent, but it's a euthanizing agent that's used for cats, dogs, horses. It's not used in the animal agriculture industry for cows or pigs or chickens or meat that humans are going to eat, because it is a toxic substance. It kills. That's what it's designed to do. So, or rather, that's what it's used for. So, so how pentobarbital ended up in the meat supply chain for pet food is still a big unknown. And so, because as we just mentioned, it's clearly then not just cows and pigs and chickens that are going into that pet food supply chain, but there's other meat sources getting into there as well, if pentobarbital was present. I think one of the main challenges with the current pet food supply chain is that, you know, the source of the meat is just not, it's not traced. And I think there was a recent study actually that came out in the Guardian newspaper that showed a research group, academic group in Singapore, actually discovered through some DNA sequencing that some of the seafood in cat food is actually various endangered sharks. So I think this just goes to show that the pet food industry is sort of this catch-all for meats or byproducts and animals. I guess the undiscerning cat or dog is not going to notice the difference with respect to when they're eating. But the challenge is that when you don't have transparency, absolutely there can be problems associated with contamination or other issues that could potentially lead to ill health of animals.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on there. I mean, we know our oceans are contaminated with toxins, and then also the natural prey of cats is not sharks, obviously, or cows or chickens. So, I think there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, and I suppose that's, you know, one of the reasons why at Because Animals we focused on mouse as opposed to making cultured mouse. So perhaps I could just give you sort of an overview of what we're doing. To take animals out of the supply chain. So basically what we're doing is we're creating something called cultured meat as opposed to slaughtered meat. And so cultured meat is meat, it is animal tissue, but what we do is we grow those cells outside of the animal. We grow them in a bioreactor, which is basically just a vessel that is warm and allows for gas exchange. We feed those cells nutrients. So the cells actually experience an environment that is very, very similar to what those cells would experience inside the body of an animal, but they're experiencing it inside the infrastructure of a bioreactor. And so we're creating cultured meat because precisely because, dogs and cats, dogs are widely, but they scientifically, they're absolutely known to be omnivores, and cats in the wild are obligate carnivores. We know that scientifically, we can feed cats a nutritionally complete diet that does not involve any kind of meat, because we can obtain all of those nutrients. When we're talking about a commercial diet, we can obtain those essential nutrients that cats need, like taurine, arachidonic acid, vitamin D. We can obtain them from non-animal sources when we are able to formulate that food commercially. In the wild, though, it's important to note, there's not one single source of a food product that an animal, that a cat could eat. And this is why cats are, why there's the very, very, very wide misconception that, it's impossible to feed a cat a plant-based diet. It's not, if it's formulated properly. But the challenge is that the majority of people won't accept that argument, and there's a real emotional connection between, of course, people and their pets, and this idea that cats are obligate carnivores in the wild really propels people into wanting to feed their cats a meat-based diet, because in the wild, that's what they would eat. So what we are doing is we are giving people the product that they want, which is meat. But of course, as I mentioned, we are not slaughtering animals to get that meat. And rather than creating chicken or beef or seafood, because as you mentioned, those are not protein sources that a tabby cat in the wild will eat, we focus on mouse, because cats in the wild eat mice, small birds, and insects. So mice are the evolutionarily appropriate meat source for cats. And the other important component to this is that actually chicken, beef, fish, those are also the main allergens for our cats and dogs. So in making cultured mouse, this is an opportunity to actually create a hypoallergenic diet for cats too. So this is why we focused on mouse. And we grow those cells inside of a bioreactor, and what we're able to do is we're able to grow the tissue types that the cat will eat from a mouse. So for example, a mouse is comprised of all types of different tissue. So there's muscle, there's fat, there are organ tissues. And so we're able to grow those different types of cells that all have different nutritional profiles that are necessary for cats. And then the final product when we launch it will be a blend of those different cell types to really make sure that we have the nutritional profile that's spot on for cats, and that will comprise our cat food. And the nice thing about this is that as we're talking about supply chain issues and lack of transparency with respect to where ingredients, namely meat, comes from for pet food, we don't have that problem with our meat. It's a very, very clean and controlled process. We know the inputs, we know the outputs, and growing cultured meat in this way, or growing cells in a bioreactor, it's very, very similar to producing products or ingredients that consumers already readily consume and even feed to their cats and dogs. So for example, if you think about probiotics, which are bacterial cells, they're produced in a bioreactor for commercial sale. Nutritional yeast or beer, which we don't feed beer to our pets, but nutritional yeast, again, produced in a bioreactor. And these probiotics, nutritional yeast, they're known to have health benefits for our pets, and they're known to be, grown in a process that is not sort of this Frankenstein process. These are thought of as very natural products, and cultured meat is being grown in the same way. So I think this is this is why, because animals, when we started the company, my co-founder and I, Josh, we launched our brand with some early products on the market. So a probiotic-based supplement, one for dogs, one for cats, nutritional yeast-based dog cookies. And so we are using these other cultured ingredients as sort of a proxy and as a bridge to explain to people what cultured meat is and how it's made. You know, we want to be, we are trying, actively trying to be as transparent as possible, because I think really once people understand and the process is demystified, there's not any reason why anybody wouldn't want to feed their pets cultured meat.
I think that's a really important part, and that's kind of my like hang up, because I'm like, this is great, like kind of the best of both worlds, but I don't have a background in how this is developed. So to hear, you know, that it's developed in these natural ways, of course, you know, a lot of us vegans love the nutritional yeast, so I think that is a really great comparison to help us understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it is. It would be considered an industrial process that's more or less identical to the industrial process that does create nutritional yeast or probiotics. And you know, we think of those, and these are widely known to be natural ingredients, natural products that do have tremendous health benefits and functionality. So I think this is really, of course, the way that we are. I'm looking to explain the creation of cultured meat, because it's really not much more complicated than that.
That makes sense. And it does sound like when you hear about it, like even with cultured meat that they're developing for humans, just always wonder, like you use that word Frankenstein, that's kind of where my head would go too. So I think this is really important to get that information out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we understand that. We do know that this is something that, it, you know, it's a new food ingredient. And of course, people are going to want to understand what it is before embracing it. That's a totally normal and natural thing. And so we want to make that process easy for people. And we are more than happy trying to go out of our way to be as transparent and open about it as possible, because it really is quite incredible. And there is absolutely nothing to hide.
That sounds great. You're listening to That Vegan Show on KBOO Portland. Before we continue our interview, I want to remind you that this is a great time to become a KBOO member. Show your support for That Vegan Show and for KBOO by becoming a KBOO member today. Just need to go to kboo.fm/give and help us meet our 56,000 spring drive goal. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. We've been talking with Shannon from Because Animals, and she's been telling us about cultured meat and what her company is doing to help develop that food for our cats and dogs. I had a question about how long has cultured meat just overall been in development or researched?
Yeah, no, great question. The first company to really come onto the scene was at the time Memphis Meats. It's now referred to as Upside. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was around 2014. 2014, I think, that they sort of kicked things off. So, and then since then, it's sort of been a snowball of other companies. And so now there are globally over 100 companies that are working on cultured meat, all of them with the exception of Because Animals for human consumption. But so it's been not quite a decade, but almost in the commercial sphere. Academics have also been researching cultured meat, and a not-for-profit organization called New Harvest, they actually actively sponsor or provide grants for individuals wishing to pursue a master's or PhD or postdoc in cultured meat research. This past year, at Tufts University, actually, the USDA, I believe, actually bestowed a $10 million grant onto Tufts University for cellular agriculture research. So another way cultured meat goes by a few names, cellular agriculture is one of them. So the academic community is also investigating cultured meat. But I'd say that really, if we think about growing animal cells outside of the animal's body, we've been doing that as a research community, as a scientific community for decades. This is not new. What is new is being able to grow those cells in a way that allows us to get the price down to a point that is commercially viable. And that's it. So, you know, yeah, growing cells outside of the animal, I should just sort of say it again because it's an important point to make. It is not new. This is what researchers have been doing for many decades now. It's really just about, I'd say almost all of the innovation is really around actually how we can just do this in a way that is not commercially or cost prohibitive for a consumer.
So there have been people who've eaten the cultured meat?
So these researchers in the lab, they're not eating the cells that they're growing. They would be used studying them for research purposes. So since then, for those companies that have been in the commercial sphere, they have produced products that people have eaten, but I don't believe there have been any, like, you know, huge, there have definitely not been any cohorts, for example, or scientific studies, to my knowledge, yet on the consumption of cultured meat. What we do know is when we think about these cells, grown outside of the body, and we think about, okay, you know, we know biochemically what these cells are, because we know what they are. Well, we've known what they are for what they're comprised of or what they've been made up of. We've known this for a long time. And so when we can compare these cells to the cells that come from an animal, there's really not a whole lot of differences aside from some of the pieces that you would think about. So in terms of what an animal is eating, some of those components are not controlled for necessarily. So, or sometimes they are controlled for, but in ways that we wouldn't like as a consumer. So for instance, antibiotics are something that are widely fed to livestock, not as a way to treat infection, but their antibiotics are given prophylactically because they also happen to have this other secondary effect, which is to make animals tend to gain more mass. So these antibiotics are used sort of very, very indiscriminately. And of course, we know that before COVID came along, everybody was talking about, one of the major health threats globally is the development of antibiotic resistance. And 80% of the antibiotics produced in the US are sold to animal agriculture. So it doesn't take a lot to sort of put the pieces together to say, okay, well, what is the industry that's primarily responsible for antibiotic resistance? So anyway, the point is that when you're consuming an animal-based product, you don't always know what that animal was eating or what that animal was fed or injected with. And so there are unknowns. If you think about, for those people who would eat meat, for example, you know, if you go and you're buying a slab of meat or whatever on a Monday, and then you buy another slab on a Thursday, there will be differences. There will be differences, not grave differences, not from a nutritional perspective, but there will be differences because it's likely coming from a different animal, different cut of meat, etc. One of the real benefits to cultured meat is that because it is so highly controlled, in that we know, as I said, what the inputs are, what the outputs are, and it's also a very homogeneous process. You can't really build an industrial scale process without having extraordinary homogeneity. So the nice thing is that, you know, we know what this product is between a Monday and a Thursday. And so there's just a lot more control, and there are, ironically, there's there stands to be much more known about cultured meat than we have ever known about slaughtered meat.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's like you said, it's more controlled. Like, I don't know, I don't remember the number, but I mean, you hear like within a hamburger, there could be, you know, X number of animals just even in that ground beef. So, yeah, it's reminding me of like the seaweed that they grow outside of the ocean, which is appealing because then it's not going to have, you know, all the toxins and things that are in the ocean. So this is a similar thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I suppose that is actually a nice analogy, where for folks who actually then who are companies that are growing different types of algae in, I mean, I guess referred to as these sort of racetracks, or basically these really, really huge pools growing microalgae. And yeah, the benefit is that, again, that is, it's also a very, very controlled environment, tested very, very regularly for any potential contaminants. As you say, unlike the ocean, which is a totally wild space. And yeah. You know what? I mean, that's what an animal agriculture farm is. It's totally wild. And if we think too about, you know, the way that animals, when animals are afraid, and the stress hormones that they would be producing before they're slaughtered, all of these things have an effect on the meat. These are, so there are some, you know, and whether or not those stress hormones or those chemicals actually have a detrimental effect on health, I don't think that's ever been studied, not in any, with any kind of scientific rigor anyway, but that is just, it happens to be that this is something that, you know, we won't see, for example, in cultured meat. So there will be differences, but arguably those differences are on the side of being positive. The other benefit is that when animals are, I mean, of course, they're raised and they're slaughtered in a quagmire of no better way to describe it. It's just their own feces.
Right.
And so when that animal is carved up, invariably there are traces of fecal bacteria. And I think there was a study done a few years ago from a third party group that basically sort of randomly tested, I don't know how many thousands of raw meat products that were available in various grocery stores. And they said, okay, how many of these, you know, if we take this raw meat sample and we test it to see whether or not any bacteria will actually grow from it, any fecal bacteria specifically, what percentage? And it was 100%. So 100% of meat contains, basically there's animal or the bacteria that would come from
that. Yeah, we can't say but I can edit it out.
Okay, well, I'm using that word because it's just like it's the most, there's no reason to sugarcoat it, but I understand what you're saying. So the bacteria that are basically come from farmed animal feces has been found in 100% of meat that's been tested on the grocery store shelves. And this is why, right? This is why, okay, you have to cook meat really well, because all of it will grow out pathogenic bacteria if it's raw, if it's left in the heat, and so on and so forth, because those microbes are there, and they are there from animal feces. We don't have any feces in our lab.
Right.
We don't have any feces in our cultured meat.
Right, yeah, and I think it's so important to illuminate these points, because even myself, who like is really excited about being able to, you know, feed my cats something I feel is much more ethical, you know, there is that little voice in my head, but well, you know, has it been tested long enough, or, you know, is it going to have issues? And really the issue is more all of these unknowns that are in the food already.
Yeah, I would say that's exactly it. I would say that's a much bigger challenge. And actually, we've received a lot of really positive responses from veterinarians who are proactively getting in touch with us saying, as soon as your product is ready, please tell me, because I want to sell it through my clinic. And so Yeah, there has been, there definitely, veterinarians will say so, over the past 10 or 20 years, if they're more mature and they've been practicing for that long, that there's been an increase, a spike in various types of diseases in animals. And who knows, again, without, you know, I'm a very big proponent of let's just do the science to figure out what the cause is. But until that, so we cannot say conclusively that it's the source of the food, but we also can't say conclusively that it's not the food. What we know is there's been an increasing instance of various types of diseases, and in situations that, you know, otherwise we don't necessarily see there being major changes in terms of, you know, okay, the animals, unlike humans, for instance, who are, okay, you know, people are now working longer days, they're much more lethargic or sedentary. It could be the case that, you know, our pets, because there's inactivity, that's certainly a contributing cause, but we don't know, we can't pinpoint it. And so so there's no reason to believe that diet, current commercial pet foods, don't have a role in the increase in instances of disease. That's something to be determined. And I think, yeah, I'll leave it at that. That's something definitely that is one of the variables.
Definitely. I mean, I have a background in human nutrition, and, you know, obviously they, you know, like you said, it can't be conclusive, but it is widely thought that your diet is contributing to various diseases. Like, one of my cats had diabetes, went blind. Some of my cats have had cancer or kidney disease, you know, at the end of their life. And, you know, I feel strongly, and I think, you know, at some point there'll be more evidence that the diet has, for all these reasons you're talking about, like, it's not their natural animals they would eat. It's got all these hormones and contaminants and disease in it. Yeah, it's hard to think that that isn't probably a pretty big role in what's going on.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it's it definitely, you know, it is. It's far from having been ruled out. That is for certain. Yes.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about some of the products that you have currently on the market.
Yeah, so we have a probiotic-based supplement, one for dogs and one for cats. And this particular probiotic that we include in our current supplement, actually, it's one of the very few that has dozens of peer-reviewed papers or scientific support for sort of justifying that actually this is to make the claims around this probiotic improving digestive health and immunity. And so something that a lot of people don't necessarily think about when they're buying a probiotic is, you know, a probiotic is not just a probiotic. It's really important to think about what type of probiotic that is, because a lot of bacteria don't actually make it through the gastrointestinal tract, because of course it's a very, very highly acidic environment, the gut. And those bacterial cells can largely be destroyed. So the probiotic that we use is called it's called Bacillus subtilis. It's a type of it's a strain of Bacillus subtilis, which is it's known to be a probiotic, has these health benefits, but importantly, it's also a spore-forming bacteria, which means that it has this really exquisite protective mechanism where it exists in this dormant or spore state, and these spores are incredibly hardy, so they can withstand heat, pressure, acidic environments, and so those spores will make it through the gastrointestinal tract. Once they're actually down in the intestine, that's when those spores would sporulate, and sort of those bacteria can then sort of do their magic. So yeah, so we use a scientifically backed, proven probiotic. And then our nutritional yeast, We actually are just in the process of launching our own proprietary blend of nutritional yeast, which is called, and it will be on the shelves soon, but not yet. It's called Bimune, and basically this is, as I say, a combination of yeasts, nutritional yeasts, or Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that have been shown, these various strains, to have support for the immune system. So we have right now some nutritional yeast based dog cookies, and nutritional yeast is widely known to be a great source of various types of B vitamins. Mm-hmm. And this year we will also be rolling out a nutritionally complete yeast based dog food. So that's something for folks to look out for closer to the end of this year. So as we're still continuing to work on cultured meat and bringing down the cost so that we can, you know, make the product commercially viable, in the meantime, we are working towards producing as many products that don't contain cultured meat, but nonetheless have tremendous functional benefits for pets. We're working on as many of those products as possible.
So not only are you taking out all of the bad things in the current pet food supply, you're adding things that will be healthy and supporting the immune system.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, you know, as somebody, my pets, I mean, as somebody who I try to, with all of the foods I feed myself, look at, okay, does this have a positive impact on other animals, on the environment? And, you know, I'm thinking, of course, I want to do the same for my dogs and cats, but I'm not willing to, probably like you, probably like a lot of people, as much as this cause is so, or this mission is so incredibly important to me, I'm not going to put my own pet's health at risk for the benefit of the environment or other animals. And so I'm acutely aware, because I am a pet parent myself, I'm acutely aware of how important it is to, you know, it's not enough for us to produce a product that is even as good as the current products in the market, because frankly, you know, I'm not sure how, especially those meat-based products, I'm not sure how good most of them actually are. And so the important thing is that we're creating a product that is, first and foremost, yeah, it's actually better for pets. And, you know, so the gravy on top, if we use that sort of
the mushroom gravy on top.
Yeah, that's right. Is that it just so happens that the food that stands to be the safest and most nutritionally robust food for cats and dogs, you know, that food is also going to be the only food on the market that is also truly humane and environmentally sustainable.
That's really exciting. I'm really excited about this, and I'm so happy you could be here to tell me and also all the listeners about this. Is there kind of a estimated date on when it may be affordable and coming on the market?
So we are working very hard to launch our cultured mouse cat cookies. So we'll launch first a treat before the full nutritionally complete food. So to launch those cookies at the end of 2024. And largely, you know, the other reason why this is going to take some time, it's bringing down the cost is one thing, but also just creating the actual infrastructure to be able to grow as much meat as we need to grow, is that industry, that infrastructure just doesn't exist yet. So this is something that we need to do sort of in parallel with research. We also need to be thinking about actually, yeah, making sure that we're set up to hit the ground running from a commercial perspective once we're ready to do so. So ideally we'd be making, you know, a slow start at the end of 2024 and then gradually continue to increase our volumes.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're doing something really innovative. So there's, you know, not a lot of guidelines probably on how to, like you said, keep up with demand. Okay, great. I'm going to pause for a second to talk about our spring drive here. Our spring drive is going on now through May 28th, and our on-air goal is 56,000. It's important to support and donate to KBOO if you can, because 80% of our funding comes from our members to support shows like this show, that vegan show, where we get to learn about all these innovative things going on to help the animals. Less than 10% of our listeners are members of KBOO, so we'd love to increase that. We've been talking with Shannon, who is the CEO and co-founder of Because Animals. She's been telling us about the development of cultured meat for cats and dogs, and also some of the other products that are already on the market. I know we've touched on some of the environmental benefits of using the cultured meat rather than animal agriculture as it is now, but I'd like to maybe get into that a little bit more.
Sure.
Okay. So I know we've touched on like that they're using sharks or and the antibiotics and hormones, and the, you know, of course, as vegans, we would prefer that the animals are not slaughtered or kept in terrible conditions their whole life. What other health benefits are there, either environmental or public health benefits?
Well, I mean, I'd say in terms of gas emissions, I mean, if you think about the animal agriculture, I mean, I guess if we just sort of break it down in terms of within the environmental bucket, animal agriculture is one of the primary drivers of greenhouse gas emissions. It's one of the main drivers of basically clearing habitable land in order to, you know, grow more crops to then feed more cattle, use of water. So the environmental piece alone, yeah, there are many layers there. And so as soon as we unplug animal agriculture, we stand to see, you know, a lot of those problems largely be mitigated. So then of course, yes, there's the problem with the actual treatment of the animals themselves involved in the animal agriculture industry. That sort of goes without saying, although I mean, yeah, we've been saying it for a long time, though the humane issue is just not one that seems to resonate amazingly with a lot of people. But fortunately, that is also something that, you know, taking animals out of the supply chain, it means that they don't live in total states of suffering. So in terms of public health, so definitely the animal, the antibiotics that are used, as I mentioned in the US, 80% of those antibiotics are used to feed, they go into livestock feed, which makes the development of antibiotic resistance, the driver of that, makes the animal agriculture industry the primary driver of this very, very real and massive public health threat. The other thing that's rather timely is when we think about pandemics, and all pandemics in history have come from basically a virus that has come from an animal. And so typically viruses don't cross the they don't cross the species barrier, but when they do, they're bad. They're very bad viruses. And so what we know is that when animals are confined and they're in very, very stressful conditions, and these stressful conditions also make them defecate more, and there's a lot of virus being shed in fecal matter, and especially when you have situations like, for example, in I guess the wet markets in China, where animals, live animals, are kept in cages on top of one another, and basically fecal matter drips down from one cage onto another animal, and so on down and down. And so now you have just this sort of horrible, perfect storm for a virus to basically continue to mutate and to be able to evade all of these all of these otherwise undesirable circumstances in order to, you know, basically stop a virus, it's just continuing to get stronger and more virulent. And so when we think about, yeah, all the pandemics in history, and they've all originated with an animal, a non-human animal. And if we eradicate animal agriculture, this is a very good opportunity for us to minimize the risk of future pandemics. So there's no shortage of reasons why animal agriculture just needs to be completely overhauled and to frankly not exist.
I couldn't agree more. In your experience, I know you said a second ago that unfortunately, like, the cruelty to animals or killing animals is not always resonating with people, but are, you know, concepts like what you're discussing with pandemics, or what are some things that are resonating in your experience with people who are thinking about shifting?
Well, I think so definitely I think we're seeing it more now than ever, this shift towards plant-based diets or people thinking about cultured meat, probably because now more than in the past decades, there's more talk now about the environmental effect of animal agriculture, and people are beginning to see the actual direct ramifications of climate change, and namely, floods, horrible storms, droughts. So these are all these erratic and severe weather patterns. Climate change isn't just about the overall warming of the planet. It's also tied to these very severe and erratic weather patterns. And people are seeing more of them now than they have perhaps in their lifetime. And so I think as it resonates, this, people don't have to see, they're not confronted on a daily basis with the horrors of what animals go through in these slaughterhouses or in these confinement areas, but they are confronted daily when they sort of look at their kids and they think, what's the future going to be like in 10 or 20 or 30 years for them? And so I think as people are becoming, I think it's the environmental piece that's driving most people to shift towards, or rather away from animal-based products.
Okay. Yeah, I still feel like that message isn't out there as much. Because I can't remember when Cowspiracy came out, but I think that was my, introduction to it, or, really big kind of awakening to understanding that environmental piece. And I mean, I know I have seen it out there in the media more than then it was probably practically unknown by general population. I guess I'm also wondering, you're based in Austria, how is it different in Europe or in Austria than in the States as far as the environmental understanding of how meat impacts that?
So, I mean, I'm physically, I'm based in Austria now. We're building an R&D facility here, but the company itself is still based in the US. We sell in the US. Yeah, so I mean, we're still very much a US-based company. For various business reasons, we're taking advantage of some of the opportunities that exist here for the R&D piece. But when we think about commercialization, we're definitely focused on industry, on the US.
Gotcha.
In Europe, Europe is, much of Europe is, the culture is, there's a lot of meat consumption that goes on in Europe as there is in the US.
Yeah.
That said, I think some of the differences though would involve the inclusion of antibiotics in livestock, mm-hmm. The importance to people of grass-fed or free-range animals. So that there are definitely differences. The treatment of animals in terms of the animal agriculture piece in Europe, at least Western Europe, it's very difficult to say though, because I mean, if you go to Whole Foods in the US, that's a different story. I mean, Whole Foods, sure, also is really focused on that. So Yeah, so it's tough to say. We do see statistically from a market perspective, we do see the US as being, people are embracing plant-based diets more in the US and also the UK as well, in general, much more than mainland Europe.
Okay, yeah, I'm just curious about differences that you've noticed. If there, so are there factory farms in Europe or significantly less? Or
I mean, there are. I guess it just depends on what the definition of factory farms, what it would be a definition. I think there's less land in Europe, so that, you know, could necessarily accommodate some of the scale of the farms that exist in the U.S. And there's less flat land in Europe. So yeah, I mean, I think maybe in terms of just the overall scale that differs, but in terms of sort of what goes on inside of them, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of getting off topic, but I'm just kind of always curious about how things are elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if there is more of a focus on grass-fed and things, then I would assume that people would eat less meat because you can't produce as much meat if you have those kind of facilities. But I mean, I guess a lot of cultures eat a lot less meat than we do anyway here in the mm-hmm. United States. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just kind of got a little tangential on you there. Is there anything else you feel like is you'd like to tell us about what your company is doing or cultured meat before we wrap up?
No, I think I've said everything that I wanted to say.
Great. So we've been talking with Shannon Falconer from Because Animals. She's the CEO and co-founder. And if our listeners would like to learn more about your company, where would they go? For the website or social media?
Yep. becauseanimals.com, and that's our website, and definitely all of our social handles are on our website.
Right. Well, thank you so much for being here, Shannon. I feel like this is really important and vital work that you're doing, and I'm glad to learn about it, and I will be keeping an eye on you to see when I can feed this to my animals.
Great. Well, yes, thank you very much, Melissa, for hosting me and for helping me to spread the Because Animals story.
Thank you so much. And we are out of time for today. A big thanks to our guest, Shannon from Because Animals, for being here. Remember to help KBOO reach our 56,000 spring membership goal drive by showing your support at kboo.fm/give. Or you can text KBOO to 44321. Every donation is appreciated. And that vegan show will be back next month on the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. So talk to you then.
listening to KBOO Portland.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and KBOO Community Radio is very proud to be the first FM station in the state of Oregon to program jazz. Let's celebrate KBOO's diverse jazz programming and the jocks who volunteer their talent to share their love of jazz music. Jazz Appreciation Month, or JAM as it's affectionately known, represents a sweet spot in the lives of KBOO's music lovers. So join us on Wednesdays, noon to 4, and Saturdays, 2 to 5, throughout the month of April, as we toast America's greatest art form here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO.